Professor Kath Aubrey is one of Australia's premier experts in the subject of sex and technology, or sex tech, as it's known to insiders. Professor Aubrey is leading the Australian Research Council's Digital Data Literacies for Sexual Health Policy and Practice Research Project. And it's in that role she was also involved in a sex tech hackathon recently hosted in Melbourne. To tell us all about it and why it matters to the future of good sex down under, the Professor joins us now. Good morning, Kath.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Now, tell us a little bit about your specialty and areas of interest. It's probably one not a lot of people have thought of or were even aware was being looked into.
Yeah, I have done a bit of research over 20 years, I guess, on the ways that people represent their own gender and sexuality in media, and that's evolved over the years from thinking about print and radio and television to digital media. And more recently, thinking about how that impacts on people's sexual health. So I've done work with sexual health organisations in New South Wales, thinking about dating app users' understandings of safety, risk and well-being when they're using apps and what matters to them in those spaces. More recently, I've become part of the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for Automated Decision Making and Society, which is also a mouthful, I'm sorry, but as part of that we're looking at things like automated content moderation and how that impacts on sexual health organisations' ability to promote health, how people are able to talk about sexual health online, for example. And also increasingly spaces like sex tech, which involves everything from smart vibrators that connect via Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, so you can have remote control, I guess, and collect intimate data using sensors, or things like chatbots, dating apps, all of those kinds of tech solutions. I should say too, it's not always digital technologies that count as sex tech. So your inanimate vibrator, or your analog vibrator, I should say, also counts as sex tech in many contexts. It's a pretty broad church.
Analog sex toys. It's not a phrase I've heard before, but I'm enjoying it. Now, you participated and were involved in this sex tech hackathon that just happened the weekend past. What is a sex tech hackathon for those who might not know?
Yeah, so hackathons are a kind of traditional way, not of hacking into people's sex toys. So it wasn't about, you know, getting into, I don't know, someone's chastity device and locking it down. It was much more about speculative design and bringing technologists and researchers and, in this case, it was a public interest-focused hackathon. So it was run by Dr. Zara Stardust from Queensland University of Technology, as well as myself and some other Melbourne researchers. We partnered with Sex Tech School, which is an entrepreneurial group, and we were hosted by ThoughtWorks, which is a global technology group. So it was a kind of combination of community members, people with disabilities, for example, sex work activists, digital rights activists, and so on, thinking about the space of sex tech, which is a growth industry, and thinking about how that industry can grow while still paying attention to issues like privacy, security, ethics, and as one of our presenters said, you know, how we can make sure that the products that we want to produce to make lives better don't actually make lives more dangerous for the people we're trying to support or assist.
Yeah, I have to admit, looking through the marketing materials for the event, I was initially a little bit skeptical. You know, it all looked very slick and talked a lot about entrepreneurialism and sort of that angle. But the more I actually looked into the details of it, I was really impressed with the focus on inclusion. You know, there was a lot of talk around for people with disability, LGBTIQ plus people, and women in particular. Why were those groups highlighted? What's going on in that area for those groups of people?
Yeah, so, I mean, many people will have seen, maybe not knowing that it was branded as sex tech or what's also termed femtech, if it's more focused on women's health, will have seen marketing around vibrators or new chat apps or those kinds of things that have a real empowerment edge to them, and they're often targeting alternative communities or LGBTQ plus communities or sexual minorities, or sometimes they are aimed at kind of promoting health for people with disabilities, for example, and improving accessibility. But in other cases, they're very much business as usual, so they are assuming a kind of very heteronormative, able-bodied, cisgendered person and giving us more of what we've already got. So in this case, all the academics involved in this project have both research interests but also personal kind of activist histories around sex and gender equity and sexual diversity. And we really wanted to think about what a kind of values-driven and community-driven model of sex tech could look like. It was very hard, I will say. If, you know, as we said at one point during the process, you know, if there was a universal definition of a safer space in the digital realm and it was easy to build, you know, Mark Zuckerberg would have already bought it and patented it and owned it. It is a very difficult space. It's an ethically sensitive space, and issues, for example, like the recent passing of the Online Safety Act, kind of local regulatory spaces really impact on what can be done at a grassroots level. So and yes, 3 days we only touched on the major issues, I think, and there's a lot more work that can be done in this space.
If you've just tuned in, I'm talking sex and silicone with Professor Kath Albury, and we were just reflecting there on the importance, I suppose, of including people from marginalised groups to have a say in the development of sex technologies, and you comments there made me reflect on my experiences using Grindr, which is owned by a Chinese corporation but designed and really marketed towards an American audience. And I did find some of the questions quite ableist and even a little bit alarming, you know, asking people to, or prompting users to, you know, disclose racial and ethnic identities as a way of helping people filter users, I thought was a little bit off-putting. So there's obviously consequences when we exclude certain people from the rooms where those decisions are made. Was there much discussion about things at a systemic level, or was this more sort of looking at what solutions can we create together here and now?
Yeah, so we did kind of look at both aspects of what can be done in the here and now, and obviously many people in the group really had particular skills or particular interests that focused on putting together a project that they could potentially move forward with and in a commercial sense take to market, but in a non-commercial sense, you know, maybe collaborate with a community-led tech group to make things safer or more comfortable for people who want to connect online but feel excluded or marginalised by the current technologies available. But yeah, you know, we did talk about the kind of double-edged sword of making all aspects of our identities visible online. So Nick Hollis, an HIV advocate, talked about the ways that digital platforms like Grindr, where there's an element of the profile where you can specify that you're HIV positive and you're on treatments, it's been a very good way to share information and build community understanding of you equals you, so undetectable equals untransmittable. Being able to talk about PrEP and HIV medications in that kind of hookup space has been very destigmatizing for a lot of HIV positive people, and they've really appreciated it. But at the same time, we know Grindr has been fined in Norway for breaches of local data privacy considerations. It has been cautioned in the past for sharing information that included people's health status and their conversations or their profile construction relating to their sexual health and their HIV status in places where, sex between men is criminalized or there are criminal laws relating to whether or not someone discloses their HIV status, for example, before sex. That data can be really dangerous if it gets in the wrong hands. And that's what we were talking about, the kind of tension between wanting to have open communication and wanting to destigmatize aspects of our sexual health and our sexual selves and our gender identity and those kinds of things, but also being aware that creating huge databases that can be linked to individuals potentially that focus on aspects like gender identity and sexual health and sexual practice can be really, really risky for many, many people, not just in Australia, but globally.
It sounds like an absolutely fascinating couple of days for you. Was there a particular idea or insight that really stood out for you?
Yeah, there was one that was my favourite, and I was very happy it did win second prize.
Excellent.
Overall. Yeah, it was a plug-in that assisted with sexual communication. And what I liked about it and what a lot of other people liked about it was very simple. It wasn't one of those, we'll build a new app or we'll replace something that already exists. It was about augmenting existing platforms and also could be used as a tool to increase your own self-understanding around your sexual communication skills and building your sexual communication skills. So it was, as an example of the kinds of things they mentioned, it was like, okay, so you might have a drop-down menu asking you, do you enjoy sensual massage with your partner? Yes, no. It's like, well, what do you mean by sensual massage? Is that a euphemism for a hand job, or is it actually, just a massage? So it was about really clarifying and drilling down into some of those high-level preferences. How do you want someone to break up with you? You might want a click button that says, yeah, it's okay to ghost me. How does the other person know if you don't tell them? So that's what we really loved, that that entry, and I'm very glad they won a prize, and I hope they can take that one forward.
Brilliant. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. We've barely scratched the surface of any of these topics. If people are listening and they're curious about your research and your work or about the hackathon, where can they go to find out more?
Yeah, so I have an email on the Swinburne University of Technology website. I am the only Kath Albury at any Australian university, so I'm pretty easy to Google. We have two new projects. One is the AIC project that I'm running on digital and data literacy for sexual health. There is another sex tech project starting later in this year, a collaboration between myself and Zara Stardust, and that's a collaboration with Professor Jenny Sunden from Stockholm in Sweden. So people who are interested in sex tech or who are interested in the digital aspects of sexual health or are interested in both can certainly be involved in projects over the next 3 to 4 years.
Brilliant. Well, we'll definitely have to have you back on the show at some point to keep us updated on some of these really fascinating topics. Thank you once again for joining us this morning.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
And that was Professor Kath Albury from Swinburne University and the Australian Research Council talking about how sex tech can be made better and safer for everyone. And as Kath mentioned there, if you want to get in touch with her about her research or perhaps find out a little bit more about the sex tech hackathons, You can do so through email, kaubrey@swin.edu.au.